The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week on the show, I meet British-Pakistani actor Riz Ahmed, starring in Michael Winterbottom's Trishna, a modern-day reworking of Tests of the D'Urbervilles. And I'll be joined by Henry Barnes to review some of the week's other releases, including Taylor Kitsch in the epic John Carter, a Scots rom-com, The Decoy Bride, and Brit gangster flick, Hard-Boiled Sweets. Yes, it's the mint humbug of film podcasts. It's Film Weekly.
Personal army.
Sorry, sir.
But they couldn't stop you from getting injured.
How's your dad?
Sir, he's still in the hospital. He has chest injuries.
Is this your sister?
Yes, sir.
What's your name?
My name is Devshri.
Devshri?
Smile?
She just ran away from him.
He's got to work a lot faster than this.
So if your dad's in hospital and you got a broken arm, what are you guys going to do?
It is going to be very difficult now. Mm. Because my father had to pay the loan for the jeep.
No, Jay, you gotta go, man.
Yeah, 1 minute. Have you got a phone number or something?
No, sir, my phone broke in an accident.
My father's got a hotel near Jaipur. I can get my father to send a letter to your family. I'll bring you a job.
Thank you, sir.
Come, bro.
Get well soon. I hope it works out.
Thank you, sir.
I hope your dad gets better.
This week, British director Michael Winterbottom's Trishna is released and continues his preoccupation with English novelist Thomas Hardy after his versions of Jude and The Claim. Trishna is, of course, a twist on Hardy's classic Tests of the D'Urbervilles. This time, the love story is set not against the rolling hills of Wessex, but the heat and colour of India, and it stars the Indian actress Frida Pinto and British actor Riz Ahmed. Riz has, of course, collaborated with Winterbottom before in Road to Guantanamo, but he was first on Film Weekly when he was in the BIFA-nominated Shifty in 2008. He went on to star for Chris Morris in the controversial Four Lions, and I'm delighted to welcome him back to the show to discuss his role in Trishna. Welcome back to Film Weekly, Riz.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a while. Shifty was the last time you were on.
Was it?
Yeah.
Actually, I think I might have come on... not physically here, but by phone for Four Lions.
For Four Lions as well. Yeah, we're regular. We like to track you. Yes, we are watching you. It's all right. And justly so, because this is a big part for you, Trishna, a Michael Winterbottom movie. Tell me about working with him, because he is so prolific, very quick, but obviously went on location here. What was it like going to India, working with Michael in that environment?
As you say, he's kind of very... kind of fast and loose in lots of ways, but he's also incredibly kind of detailed and specific about the way he sets certain things up. So it's a very kind of unique combination of those two energies that he has on set. From an acting point of view, it's kind of starts off being terrifying, and then it becomes quite liberating, because you realize you can't, in a sense, no one really knows what's meant to happen, so you can't make a mistake. You can't really get it wrong. So that's very freeing once you kind of make your peace with the, you know, perpetual confusion.
Mm. It's interesting because your character in this, he's not the most... He starts off likeable, but he becomes quite unlikable.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I think that's the kind of journey that Michael wanted the character to take. And it was interesting for me actually watching it as well, because, you know, because there was no script at all, just a kind of story outline in Michael's head, We tried every scene so many different ways. So I was really kind of interested to see what version of the character Michael would then craft from the edit.
Right.
Because, you know, this could have been any one of 10 different films.
Oh, okay. That's so very much you really, and you really, even in the final version, you've ended up with no script. So you travelled to India with no script, knowing that it was a version of Tess.
Yeah, it was a version of Tess. And I think for the Indian kind of filming permission, they knocked up a script, but the front page of the script said, this is not a script. And we were kind of banned from looking at it, because I think Michael just likes to work with improvised dialogue. And in lots of ways, I think, you know, he tells stories in very visual ways, and kind of uses a lot of techniques that kind of mean, it's not about the kind of dialogue moving the story forwards at all. It's more, particularly with a tragedy like, you know, Tess, an adaptation of Tess, it's kind of fate, isn't it?
But did you read Tess? Did you get more idea of where you were going, having sort of read Tess?
I
watched the TV series.
I did read that, yeah, because for people who know Tess, there are two kind of male leads in that. There's Angel Claire and there's Alec d'Urberville. And Michael wanted to combine the two characters in Jay. And I think that's quite a kind of clever way to go because, you know, in the book, Angel's more kind of spiritual, I think is how Michael puts it, and Alec is more sensual. And Michael said, look, I think most people are a combination of both, and I think it's just about finding the balance of which way he's kind of leaning between those two characters throughout the journey. So yeah, he starts off more kind of, you know, loved up and romantic like Angel, and he ends up a bit more kind of self-destructive and cruel like Alec.
Is that why it went to India? Is that where what he finds in India, Michael? Is that there is a mix of pure ancient spirituality and then kind of modern kind of hard-nosed commercialism and dog-eat-dogness?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And particularly a lot of the issues that were really kind of important at the forefront of Hardy's mind when he was writing Tess about kind of, you know, an agricultural revolution taking place and like, you know, overnight modernization that was kind of disrupting old ways of life, and also there being a very kind of conventional sexual morality, which meant that women's lives were kind of, you know, I think a lot of those issues are still really, really, and the kind of class gulf you have between a landowner like Alec and someone who works on the land like Tess in the novel, you know, you can't find that to the same extent in the UK, but in India you still can. So a lot of those kind of dynamics are really, really fresh and real in India today. So I think that's what the thinking was.
Well, it was certainly there because, I mean, you play the son of a wealthy, let's call him a landowner, but he owns hotels, really. Mm-hmm. That's a very strong kind of current pull. You're obviously educated in India. You fall in love with a local girl, a sort of simple girl, if for want of a... No, that's a brother. But that's what Tess was, and that's what Frida Pinto plays in this too. So there's an interesting kind of internationalism there. And then you're never quite sure of your character's motives, really. Is he really going to stick it out? Is he just going to go back to London? Does he really want to be in the city?
And I think that's absolutely right. And I think the point is that I don't think Jay really knows what he's doing. I think the fact is he's a privileged guy and he's kind of found himself drifting through life until the point where he's kind of, his dad has said, all right, you can have your, you know, one last backpacking jolly around the world. But then after that, you stay put in India and you kind of help run the family business. And he's very reluctant to do that. And I think that's something that you see, hopefully, in the kind of scenes between Jay and his father, is that there is something of the petulant adolescent about him still, you know, that sense of entitlement and that sense of kind of, no, I don't want to, you know, and that sense of kind of, you know, the kid that throws the toys out the pram. And by the end of the film, you see that in its most kind of ugly manifestation.
Do you know that? I mean, you're Anglo-Pakistani by birth.
I mean, Anglo-Pakistani would mean mixed race. So no, I'm British Pakistani, right, in the sense that I'm... my parents are both ethnically Pakistani, but I'm born and raised in Britain.
So do you have a relationship with Pakistan in your sense, or do you know a community that has that relationship with what was the motherland, that going backwards and forwards, still family you're visiting, that a sense of entitlement?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't visited Pakistan regularly growing up in life. I think going back there was a massive kind of rediscovery and a massive culture shock in lots of ways. And I think for Jay, when he goes back to India, there is something of the kind of, you know, the middle class backpacker about him, in that he falls in love with India's kind of, he kind of romanticizes and idealizes, you know, India's spiritual kind of dimension. And for him, Trishna is the embodiment of that. And so he's drawn to her on that level, but also on another level, on a kind of landowner, kind of son of a businessman level, he wants his own project. He wants to step out of his dad's shadow. And for him, Trishna is that project. It's going to be his hotel, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know?
Or his little pet. She's the pet in the hotel.
Exactly, yes.
It strikes me as odd, isn't it, that I'm just thinking, talking to you there, and Frida Pinto, obviously she's still going out, well done to him, Dev Patel, who's in the best exotic marigold gold hotel at the moment on the screens, which he plays a kid who's been wants to run this hotel that his dad's kind of left to him, which is a bit bizarre.
Course.
Frida Pinto, obviously his girlfriend, was in Slumdog Millionaire, which is shot in India. Yeah. Dev and you grew up quite near each other. I mean, I'd imagine you did.
Yeah, I've met him a couple of times, really, really briefly, and seems like an absolutely lovely guy.
Yeah.
Really tall.
Yeah.
Like, you don't realize that. He's huge, isn't he?
Yeah.
And, yeah, lovely guy. I mean, he grew up, like, very close to where I grew up. It's an interesting little kind of area, you know, northwest London. I think Jay Sean grew up around the corner from us as well. And
me not far away.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So all the Asian media people seem to be gravitating there.
Is it? I mean, it seems to be that India might be the sub. I mean, since Slumdog Millionaire, it has that kind of, it's kind of energized the culture. We see Bollywood is more mainstream now than it was. Is that an interesting kind of mix? I'm seeing that the Indian audiences are catered for more in the mainstream, not just by Bollywood, but by actresses like Frida Pinto and yourself, who were only last week, I was going to add to this, in Jean-Jacques Annaud's Black Gold, playing Arab characters, but you're in there.
Yeah, we're both in that film. I think the hope is that, you know, actress like Frida or, you know, Dev or myself kind of are able to appeal to all audiences. And in, to some extent, I think the fact that, you know, there are more kind of visible and, you know, numerous kind of faces from ethnic minorities on screen means that hopefully we can start moving into a kind of post ethnic, you know, casting era. I mean, that might be a bit kind of idealistic to some extent, but I think we are definitely headed that way. In terms of,
is that
like
something
kind of,
you feel? I mean, is that a tangible thing that's happening in your career? I mean,
Shifty.
You were cast in Shifty, which is still a film that I'm very, very fond of, and we'll do anything to plug it and make more people see it because not enough people saw it, as you know.
It did really well on DVD.
I know, because good audiences that flocked to it. But your character in that wasn't Asian as such, was it? I don't know on the script
well,
where
it's interesting
what he was.
Because I mean, well, I guess what you mean is he's not. His ethnicity is incidental.
Yes.
It's not central to the story. And yeah, I think that has happened more. I think I've got Ill Manners coming out soon with Plan B, which is his directorial debut. Really exciting film. And again, you know, my ethnicity is not touched upon. It's not central to the story in any way. But I think, strangely, even when it is central to the story, I think if you deal with, if you know, writers and directors deal with stories in a way that kind of puts people's personalities and their humanity first, then it will always transcend their ethnicity, even when it's central. So, for example, Four Lions, in a weird way, that is so kind of about being a young, you know, British, Pakistani, Muslim, disenfranchised. But the way it's dealt with, it just transcends that completely.
Yeah.
And it kind of stops being about that at all. So I kind of feel that, like, you know, roles are only as limited as, you know, as we kind of, how do I put this? I think that roles are only as pigeonholed as the stories are narrow,
yeah.
If that makes any sense.
I mean, it's interesting. Casting directors have to get over it. Directors have to get over it. Writers have to get over it. But as an actor, what can you do? I guess you just kind of turn up and be yourself. You can't really pretend to be anything else, even though that is the job you're doing, is pretend to be another person, another character. But you've just got to be true to that inside yourself and not think, well, you know, I've got to be Asian. I've got to play it up in some way.
No, I mean, I think just, you know, most actors want to just play as much of a kind of diverse range of roles as possible. And in that sense, I just feel really lucky that I've been
going
able
on for
to do that, you know. I think kind of looking back, but also luckily with the films that are coming up now, they're all very different roles in very different films, and I feel really lucky about that. And yeah, I don't really think, try not to think too much about
it's different
else.
I mean, you're so Jean-Jacques Annaud, big epic filmmaker, then the kind of much looser kind of work with Michael Winterbottom, I imagine much more handheld and kind of in and out, so very different kind of disciplines for an actor.
Yeah, actually Black Gold was a massive learning experience for me, whereas I'd worked with Michael before for Road to Guantanamo. I'd never worked on a kind of massive action epic before. And, you know, like 500 horses, 200 camels, 1,000 extras, 1920s aeroplane, explosions, donkeys, tents.
This is your rider, is it?
Yeah, exactly. That was just on my trailer. So it was nuts, you know, for Black Gold. And I think it is a different kind of skill to some extent. You have to kind of manage your energy in a different way because there's so much more waiting around. And you have to kind of, it's slightly more technical as well, because if there's a huge shot that takes in aeroplanes, donkeys and, you know, bleeding tribesmen, and then you have to land your line at a certain moment and then move on, there's a kind of technical, there's a certain craft to it that is really important as well. And it was new to me, you know, it's totally different to work with the kind of way we worked with Michael on Trishna.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, Black Gold is a beautiful film as well. I'm not quite sure it kind of fully works, but you were very funny in it as
Thank
well,
you.
Which is nice. Kind of gave it an edge. I was like, oh, get him back as well. working with Taha Rahim as well, which must have been, I mean, he's
that was really
super actor,
exciting. Yeah, I was absolutely just buzzing when I heard that he would, you know, we'd be playing brothers in it. And yeah, I'm really glad, you know, we got along really well. We still keep in touch, and you know, I'd love to work with him again in the future.
Because he's, I mean, we're talking about you breaking out of ethnic roles, for example. He's got to break out of being a French person roles, which he's doing, it seems.
Yeah, yeah. I think everyone has their cross to bear, you know, and I think that's just the nature of the beast. But yeah.
But it's looking good for you. So Ill Manners, the Ben Drew film, Plan B film, coming out in May. I've heard lots of great things about it. Yeah. But one of the things that you notice about you and him is that you're both rappers in other kind of pockets of your profession. Did you jam? Is that what rappers do?
Well, we've actually kind of been long time kind of, I don't know, collaborators, I suppose you'd say. He did a cameo in my music video for Sour Times. He was introduced to me by DNR Films, who are kind of central to kind of helping put Ill Manners together as a project, and have been central to like kind of putting together a lot of my music videos. So we kind of, in that sense, we share, you know, DNR Films as friends. He did a cameo for Sour Times. Then we did a track together for Shifty. Then I acted in Ill Manners that he directed, and we've actually just done a track together that is up. That's out now, and
is that to promote the movie, to promote the Ill Manners?
No. That's just a track from my album, and it's featuring Ben. And actually, in the video, is starring Jodie Whittaker, who's one of my favorite actresses. So he's just someone who I think is really interested. We both got similar interests.
Is that? I mean, because it's kind of time honored, the pop star, the kind of actor doing a pop song, and then the pop star doing an actor. But with you two, it's kind of very much part of the whole performance, really. They're not really two divided disciplines. I see you kind of on screen, and you carry that with you.
Oh, right, that's interesting. I don't know. I've always kind of, particularly in the first few years of kind of acting and music, I was very eager to keep them completely separate, never mention one when doing press for the other. And I kind of felt like I just had to earn my stripes on both of them in a way that felt pure, you know, rather than kind of cashing in chips from one discipline to promote the other. And now I feel a bit more comfortable, you know, with the kind of reception of the last album and stuff, that, you know, the music stands on its own feet. So, I don't know, at least in terms of headspace, they are definitely, they feel very separate.
And yet you need to grow both as an actor and as a musical artist as well. You want to stay in the same place, and you're going to keep changing, I assume.
Yeah, I guess they do feed into one another in ways that maybe I'm not even aware
right.
of.
Right, really. That's what we do. We kind of stand back, criticise and kind of encourage, hopefully. So the album's out, people can download
it. Well, the single All of You is out on the 13th of March, and the album Microscope will be out at the end of June, I think 18th of June.
Brilliant.
On True Thoughts.
Okay, but for now, we can see you in Trishna and in Black Gold, which I would recommend Trishna, personally.
Okay.
Music's really good in that as well, actually.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
So the same composer is In the Mood for Love, and also this kind of rising star, the next A.R. Rahman of Bollywood, has kind of done some original songs for it as well, Amit Trivedi. So beautiful music in that.
Really good stuff. Well, we've been listening to that on the show. Absolute pleasure to have you back on, Riz Ahmed. You know what? We're going to have to get you back on for Ill Manners as well, with Ben, live in the studio or something. Riz, really lovely to have you. Congratulations on Trishna.
Cheers.
And Trishna goes on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 9th of March. But joining me now to review some of the week's other big releases is The Guardian's Henry Barnes. Welcome back, Henry. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here, Jace. Hi.
Now, Henry, we're going to look at Hard Boiled Sweet, a British gangster movie. We're going to look at The Decoy Bride, which I'll tell you about. And you can tell me about the big blockbuster of the week, John Carter. So let's start with John Carter. Here he is discovering, oh, I'm on Mars.
Sun, then Rasu.
Mercury.
Then Kosu.
Venus. Then Earth. Us.
That is Jasum. You are on Barsoom, John Carter.
Mars. I'm on Mars.
John Carter, they're played by Taylor Kitsch, Henry. Who the hell is Taylor Kitsch?
Taylor Kitsch made his name with the TV show Friday Night Lights, which was quite big in the States in 2006.
That's the American football team.
Yeah, American
was a film,
high school then, American football team, and he was kind of the bad boy in that.
Was he?
And he's excellent in that. It's really good. If you haven't seen that, you should go and catch up
right.
with it. John Carter is a story originally written by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
Tarzan
way
guy.
Back, the Tarzan guy, way back in 1912. And has now been brought to the screen by Andrew Stanton.
Is this the longest gap between book published and film finally being made?
It could well be.
Was it deemed unfilmable in 1912?
Well, apparently the rights came up to sale in the 80s, and people like, John Favreau and Robert Rodriguez have been attached to direct.
Yeah, it's funny because I read that John Favreau was attached, but he obviously went off to do Cowboys and Aliens, mm-hmm. which was another sort of, you know, someone from Mars has come down kind of thing. So he ditched that, which was a disaster anyway, because its studio head even admitted that it was crap. And John Carter, though, Andrew Stanton, who did Finding Nemo, and he's, you know, a great, he did the Narnia film as well, didn't he? He's a New Zealand director.
Yeah, he's a big guy at Pixar.
Shrek as well, yeah. So this is Pixar, but it's not cartoon.
It's not cartoon, it's a Disney film. And it's kind of, in terms of Cowboys and Aliens, it's kind of interplanetary swap over. And in this, you have a Confederate veteran of the Civil War being transported to Mars, where he becomes a hero to the native people, which are split into two groups, which is the Farks. They are 9 foot tall, got four arms, and they're bright green.
Those are big Farks.
Uh-huh. Massive Farks. And the red people, who look like normal human beings, but they've had quite a severe henna tattoo job done on them.
Right. So Mars has got people on it,
Mars
basically.
Has got... so-called people
that's
on
the
it
big,
as well.
That's the big story
these,
here.
These are the people that John Carter right. allies himself with.
I sort of read in the build-up that they're trying to sort of say it's not science fiction. But it's on Mars, Henry.
It's definitely science fiction.
Right.
It's not making any kind of political allegory as far as I can see. I mean, although I kind of like the thing of him being a Confederate soldier and then going to a planet where there's people captured and enslaved, and then him deciding to free the slaves. So there's a little bit of politics.
So
there
is that.
Switcheroo.
So I was just wondering what the character that he takes with him from Earth to Mars.
Back on Earth, he's lost his family. So he comes back from the war to find that his wife and child have been slaughtered in a horrible massacre. So his kind of escape to Mars is a chance for him to rebuild his life, find love again, and to probably make amends for things that he might have done.
Who does he find love with in Mars?
He finds love with a red woman played by Lynn Collins, whose name I forget, but you probably can make up the names in this kind of film, and you're pretty much
Klabuva.
It's very nice.
Excellent. So is that a good idea?
Yeah, I mean, the
about
chemistry...
Having an affair with an alien?
A Martian. I'm not sure what the ins and outs are, to be
honest.
Yeah,
I don't know how it works. I just don't know what the Bible would say about this.
I'm not sure either. But, I mean, the chemistry between them, between the actors, Taylor Kitsch and Lynn Collins, is actually pretty good. And, you know, considering the ludicrous situation they're in, they both carry it pretty
well. We're
well.
Talking about, you mentioned $250 million this cost. That's a lot, even by blockbuster standards.
Yep.
It's not blockbuster season, really, officially yet. It's just kind of post-Oscar season, which is normally a doldrum time. Taylor Kitsch, you know, I know he's big in Friday Night Lights. I've never heard of him. Stupid name. John Carter, stupid name for a movie. It's like Vera Drake, you know, all these names. They're not really, I never think that's a good thing to, you know, they're always rather boring just to have a name as a film. So John Carter, what's that? Lynn Collins, never heard of her. What? $250 million? Why would I go and see this film?
I guess that's the story outside of the actual narrative of the film itself, is that there's been a lot of talk about why this film is quite so expensive to make in the first place. And also the talent that they do have there, that you might recognise, people like Willem Dafoe, Samantha Morton.
Yeah,
I mean, Mark Strong's in there as the token baddie.
He's
always
he's
the token baddie.
Yeah, it's a rule.
Yeah, but those characters are actually hidden behind a lot of CGI and motion capture.
CGI, mocap, yeah. $250 million, John Carter. You're not doing it for me here, Henry. I mean, you're doing a lovely review, but you're not selling the film to me.
I think it's going to be a hard sell all round, frankly. And this has been the big story outside of the film itself, just thinking, can Disney make their money back from this? And really, do they care about it enough? Is it anything more than a vanity project for Stanton? And have Disney just said, well, we can spend this money on this director because he's got a proven track record with things like the Pixar films like WALL-E? They've also got another big release coming out later this year, The Avengers, and there's a really good piece in the LA Times at the moment about how these two films are actually essentially competing with each other for the same audience. And then on top of that, you've got the problem of them having to change the name of the film halfway through production, because apparently John Carter of Mars, as the original book is called, wouldn't appeal to women because women don't like space movies.
Right, or anyone called John Carter.
Or Mars.
Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine. I guess in America it's a bigger property that, I mean, it seems a bigger property in American literature than it is here.
It is, and apparently it's quite big in Mexico and in Eastern Europe as well. And maybe it is just me looking at it from an Anglophile point of view, but it's difficult.
When you've got a budget of $250 million, you need to make sort of double that back to kind of, you know, justify the P&A spend and all of that. So where are you, that would make it one of the films of the year. You know, is it going to be that?
It's not a tentpole movie, in fact. You know,
is it in 3D?
It's in 3D.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not a tentpole movie. You know, the size of the pole's barely going to lift the canvas off the ground on this one, I'm afraid.
Yeah, John Carter, not of Mars, then, we don't think. Not of this Earth either, so somewhere in between.
I think so.
Henry, I've seen The Decoy Bride this week. Do you know about this film?
I don't know anything about it.
I'm going to tell you about this film. We're going to hear a little clip of it first. We've got David Tennant and Kelly MacDonald as lovers on the fictional Isle of Hig.
Angus.
Sorry, is he your...
No. Should have been, probably. But I only go for arty types with monster commitment issues. My ex-fiancé was in a band. They just had a top 40 hit with the song Bedhopper.
So the clues were there.
I thought it was ironic. Stupid. But then I also thought he liked girls who, you know, give intelligent feedback. And so he told me I was just one song, not a whole album. I'm finished with relationships.
Well, they say it's when you stop looking that you...
get married?
Scottish, as you could hear. Hebridean Island. It was written by Sally Phillips, who's a friend of mine and a very nice comedian writer. She's given herself, in a very selfless way, a kind of crap part in this film. It plays the kind of agent's assistant, and the agent is trying to fix up Alice Eve to marry David Tennant on this island because paparazzi are getting in the way. And Alice Eve plays Lara Tyler, a big Hollywood star. David Tennant plays James Arbour, who's written a book called The Ornithologist's Wife, a kind of Captain Corelli-type book set on this mystical, mythical island of Hegg, which everyone's beautiful. But it turns out, of course, he's never visited Hegg before. He's made it all up. Yeah. So they arrive there to get married in this beautiful island, and it's not. It's a hellhole or a shithole, whatever you'd like to call it. Except local girl Kelly MacDonald is making a good job of making it seem quite nice. She runs around manacled to him in wedlock because she has to play the decoy bride to throw the paparazzi off the scent. It's always when these kind of ridiculous rom-coms that are pointless and really the plot is really boring, they take ages to explain to set up how sort of they don't work. It should work. There's a kind of local hero element to it, you know, Bill Forsyth film. It's got a bit of Richard Curtis Notting Hill with a kind of cross-island chase, but it just doesn't work. It looks so flat and cheap, and the lighting looks poor, and David Tennant and Kenny McDonald don't really have a chemistry. They're fine alone, but chemistry in that kind of 39 steps manacled to each other thing, it's just not working.
What about the kind of other rom-com staples? Does it have things like the kooky friend?
It's got a kooky friend.
Embarrassing elder relative.
It has embarrassing elder relative, played by Kelly MacDonald's mum. It doesn't have her kooky friend because there's no one else on the island. They're all old. I think she says population 75, average age 75. But it does have the New York fixer agent, who is the kind of like this, going mad, kind of, that would be played by Stanley Tucci if this film had a budget. Is not, instead of played by Michael Urie, who's an Ugly Betty, and he's terrible in it. So it's got all this clunky comedy that just doesn't work to charm. And it should have worked on paper. I think it probably did look quite good, but it needed a lot more oomph than the direction here.
Sounds like we should have left it on the island.
Yes. There's a running joke about the Hegg Book Club that Kelly MacDonald says to David Tennant, who gave his book 4 out of 10. Well, I can imagine the Film Society being rather more harsh about the movie. Henry, we have both seen this week a British gangster film called Hard Boiled Sweet, set in Southend among pimps, prostitutes and ex-prisoners.
That's him. Shrewd Eddie. He runs this town. So you come down here, you play on a slot machine, you pick up a whore, you buy some pills, then you're helping him get richer. He gets 10% of everything that happens here.
And everybody pays.
Everyone pays. Last fella who didn't went for a swim off the end of the pier. And he didn't get very far. Word is, Eddie strapped him up with some old car wheels instead of armbands. That's the rumour doing the rounds anyway. Are you thinking what I'm thinking?
Probably not.
Henry, the kind of wrapping of this film is that all the gangsters have names. You know, they're like Fast Eddie, he's the Mint Imperial, or someone else is the Gobstopper. This is kind of like Tarantino meets Guy Ritchie kind of subgenre going on.
If you like. I mean, I think I can safely say this is probably the worst film of the year so far for me.
Really? You ain't been seeing enough films. It's pretty bad, though.
It's pretty bad. And the idea behind the film is perhaps a little bit admirable in that the director hasn't just gone down the straight British gangster route. He's tried to blend in these elements of Elmore Leonard, of Tracy Letts even, kind of Americana small town criminal saga. And it just comes out with the worst kind of sub-Tarantino, horrible dialogue based on kind of stereotypes and cliches and massive sexism and misogyny throughout. And it's not tongue-in-cheek. It's not even winking at the camera at any point.
It would have to be funny, wouldn't it? Not light on its feet. And it just hasn't got that at all.
Mm. There's lines, off the top of my head, there's a line with something says, you do like the seaside, don't you? It's good to be beside. And you're just left thinking, in fact, I probably delivered it there with more
humour. That was actually, suddenly makes a lot of sense. Because, I mean, the cast is not particularly able or capable of delivering that. It needed a fast rhythm, it needed staccato, it needed to look better. All of the kind of things that British cinema does badly are here in Hard Boiled Sweets.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, I mean, if there's one positive point to it is that you can look at it and see that it was shot on a 5D camera. So this is a relatively new piece of technology. It's quite cheap to use, but it is difficult to make a feature film on them still. So the team that is behind it, they've done a fantastic job of making it's set in Southend-on-Sea, and they've kind of tried to shoot it as if it's Las Vegas or some sort
there's a lot of neon
joint.
And
it's, you know, that's done quite well, but when you populate that with these one-dimensional caricatures of gangsters in there's no character to them, so these lines that comes out of their mouths don't actually make any sense at all.
If you were a sweet, Henry, what would you be?
I would be like Portia and be a sherbet lemon because they're my absolute favourite. And I look like her.
If this film were a sweet, what would it be?
This film would be sweet and sour chicken left in a takeaway tray.
It would,
somewhere.
The plot is like the middle of a polo. There's nothing there. Henry Barnes, what an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast once more. What are you off to do?
I'm off to now edit a video about John Carter, so it's wall-to-wall Mars for me.
You are the John Carter coalface. Henry Barnes, lovely to see you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Jess.
And you can, of course, see Henry Barnes' videos all over the website, guardian.co.uk/film. And that brings us to a close for another edition of Film Weekly. The music we've been playing on this week's podcast, as Riz Ahmed discussed, was from the soundtrack of Trishna, with original songs by Amit Trivedi and a score by Shigeru Umebayashi. From me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, we'll see you next week. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.